The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer, guest hosting for Mr. Stephen Flurry. Mr. Flurry is traveling, I believe he's in Florida at the moment, but I'm speaking to you live from our basement in Edstone. It's absolutely beautiful, sunny day here. But I understand that it's a national day of mourning in America today. At least, I assume it is. I'm told that this is the day that America remembers becoming independent from Britain. So, I mean, I don't see how it could be anything other than just a day of mourning and wailing. Just kidding. Of course, I'd like to say a happy July 4th to all our American listeners. I'm getting the British guy to host the show on July 4th is interesting. It means that all of our American staff can, or more of our American staff can go and celebrate, but I have been threatening simply to play God Save the Queen and Rule Britannia on repeat for the next hour. But I'm not really going to do that. So instead, let's talk about some news. I wanted to start today in this first segment just to talk about a fascinating story that's emerged from Europe over the weekend. There's a lot of very interesting things going on over there after the Brexit vote, and we were discussing quite a lot of that on Trumpet Daily Radio, on Trumpet Hour last week. But one thing that's just been recently emerging, like I said, just over the weekend, something we haven't talked about so far, is that the German government in Berlin is starting to get very annoyed with the EU government in Brussels. And it seems even like Brexit could result in some kind of a showdown between Berlin and Brussels. A lot of this dislike from Berlin is focused on the European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker. He's been pretty combative post-Brexit, but he's also he's been very openly and even abrasively pro-European for quite a long time. And this morning, the media is full of reports that German Chancellor Angela Merkel is fed up with the EU's government in Brussels and that she wants regime change, that she is going to make sure Juncker is gone within the next year. This has the potential to be a very big development for Europe. And kind of officially, de jure, Europe is run by bureaucrats in Brussels. Now, de facto, it's run by Germany, it's run by Berlin. Germany has all the money. If an EU nation wants a bailout, they need Germany to be involved, otherwise there's just not enough cash, for example. You know, the fact that Germany is the biggest, the most prosperous, or at least with the largest economy, the most populous country in the European Union, that gives it huge clout. And it means that ultimately it can get its way. But there's not really a formal power there. You know, there's no EU treaty that says Germany is the top dog. There's not the Berlin Treaty or something like that that officially puts Germany in power. And so often when Germany gets its own way, it gets its own way, but it's after a lot of complicated negotiations, getting very close to deadlines. And then there's always the danger from Germany's point of view that the rest of the EU could gang up on them to put together a coalition that can outvote Germany. And 2008, when the Greek crisis was just first unfolding, Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry wrote, "However it happens, Germany is prophesied to come out on top in this financial crisis." He wrote that Europeans will succumb to a strong, united government of Europe, led ultimately not from Brussels, but from Berlin. And in so many ways, that's already happened. I mean, look at Greece last summer. Look at every single outbreak of the financial crisis. The decisions, they always revolve much more around Berlin than they do Brussels. Look at the refugee crisis. Germany hasn't dealt with that very effectively. But there's no doubt that Europe's response to the refugee crisis has come not from Brussels, but from Berlin. But now, with their frustration with Brussels and in the wake of Brexit, Germany could be about to take this to a whole new level. Now, the source for many of the stories circulating about this comes from a Sunday Times article yesterday with the title, Berlin Tells Gloating Juncker, Go! And they write, Jean-Claude Juncker, the president of the European Commission, is under pressure to resign after reportedly gloating over Britain's departure from the EU and describing it as a chance to push for greater EU integration. Angela Merkel, the German Chancellor, is understood to believe that Juncker has become part of the problem. And this article quotes a German minister. They don't say which minister, but they quote a German minister saying, Juncker has time and again acted against the common interest, and his reaction to the British referendum has been very damaging. This is not a time for institutional bickering, but the pressure for him to resign will only become greater, and Chancellor Merkel will eventually have to deal with this next year. And then this article goes on to point out that two different German newspapers last week had editorials saying that Juncker needs to resign. The Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, they said, Juncker once again shows in a fatal way how little he sees himself to be a president of the commission that represents the whole EU. But then perhaps most importantly, this article goes on to point out how the opposition to Juncker is well beyond just Germany. So the Polish foreign minister and the Czech foreign minister, they've both issued calls saying that Juncker is not the right man for the job. The Estonian president has said his behaviour is abominable. So there's more and more EU leaders calling for him to resign. They talked about how there was a bit of a power struggle with who was going to lead the Brexit negotiations, and the other EU nations stepped in and prevented Juncker's man from doing the job and gave it to someone else because they do not trust Juncker. And then they talk about how that they worked together to move a summit, a critical summit on Brexit on September 16th, out of Brussels and to Bratislava in the capital of Slovakia instead, because Slovakia now is the EU, they've taken the rotating EU presidency. This article also talks about how a lot of EU leaders are growing concerned with Mr. Juncker's apparent drinking problems. This article says that he was inebriated when they met with the Turkish president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, in November. They said on another occasion, Juncker unsettled a Brussels dinner party for the Chinese premier, Li Keqiang, by throwing ice cubes from his gin and tonic around the table. And this is something there have been quite a few reports on over the years, and even some videos that seem to show Jean-Claude Juncker being drunk at meetings. But the broader point here is very interesting. There's a potential power struggle now, or push, to move to have Berlin have a much more formal say in how the EU is governed, because all around Europe people are not happy with the way Brussels is doing things. And there are some in Brussels who are excited about Brexit, who see it as an opportunity, and it is very important to note that. But there are some, especially, especially in more the national countries, who don't like all this uncertainty from Brexit. So France is a good example of this. So François Hollande, he has a lot of reasons to be very frustrated with Britain's role in Europe. And all other things being equal, he'd probably be very glad if Britain left the European Union without any other considerations. You know, within Europe, it would make his life much easier. They'd be able to move on with the integration that he wants. But on the other hand, Britain's exit has empowered the Front National, a right-wing fringe group, possibly even a far-right group, that is doing him and is doing his party serious damage, and potentially could even cost him his job. So even though there are reasons for him to kind of welcome a Brexit, it causes him some very major headaches. And it's like that all across Europe, that same kind of situation. And so many leaders, they're annoyed at Britain, but they're also annoyed now at Brussels, at people like Jean-Claude Juncker, at the government, the EU government within Brussels. So increasingly now, all around Europe, the EU's top leaders, they're looking at Brussels and they're saying that Brussels is out of touch. They're incapable of doing the job. They're the bunglers that have kind of pushed Europe from crisis crisis to crisis. And you could see there being a lot of opposition, or a lot of this opposition to Brussels then being channeled into pushes for Berlin to take on more leadership. And you could see, with Brussels doing so badly, many of these countries in this Times article talked about how Germany, or actually, sorry, it's a Spiegel article that we're going to get to in a minute that talks about how Germany has got this coalition behind it, especially from Eastern Europe. And you could see them saying, well, you know, we don't like the way Brussels is doing things. Let's push it to Berlin instead. Let's get Germany to do more. We need Germany to do more. Germany at least would do a better job than those guys in Brussels. Now, a lot in the papers is kind of portraying this as a battle between those in Brussels who want more Europe and those in Germany and Eastern Europe who want less Europe. But that's not entirely accurate. It's about different visions for Europe. And for example, it's the Spiegel article that I mentioned, they published last Friday one. It's called Brexit Aftershocks, an Inside Look at the EU's Raging Power Struggle. And they write, it's a power struggle between two opposing camps, both of which see Brexit as an opposition to finally change Europe to conform to the vision they've long had for the bloc. And they said the protagonists of an institutionalized Europe are Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker and Parliamentary President Martin Schulz. On the other side stand the majority of Europe's heads of state and government, led by Angela Merkel, who has created an alliance on this issue with those governments in Eastern Europe with whom she was with such odds in the refugee crisis just a few months ago. So Angela Merkel, Germany leading a different vision for Europe. But is this battle about more Europe or less? Well, they go on. This article goes on to talk about the head of Poland's National Conservative Law and Justice Party, which currently holds power in the country. It says that the head of this party does not want less Europe in all areas. When it comes to foreign and security policy, he would like to see the EU play a more robust role. They're in favour of establishing a European army and would like to see a strong European president with far-reaching authorities. It is a demand that many governments in Eastern and Central Europe agree with. And these are some of the biggest possible steps towards a more unified Europe. And so really what this new alliance led by Angela Merkel wants, it's not less Europe, rather it's a different vision to the Brussels bureaucrats for how Europe should unify. Unify would be a good term for that, actually. But they don't want more regulation. They don't want to necessarily expand the power of the bureaucrats in Brussels, but you know what they do want? They do want a European army. They do want a strong president who can get things done with far-reaching authority, as the Spiegel article says. Far-reaching authority. So they don't want less Europe. They just want a different Europe to men like Jean-Claude Juncker and the Brussels bureaucracy. So this battle between Berlin and Brussels, if it does escalate to that, could be very interesting to watch. And you have to agree, things don't look good in Brussels. Could this force Germany to come in and sort things out? Could this see Germany get more directly involved in things like setting up a president, a European army, while they have all of these allies behind them? Now, it will certainly be interesting to watch. And as we've emphasized on this program, on other programs on this channel, there are so many things that we've been forecasting for years that this Brexit is just really hastening. And just to give one more quick example, Laurent Wauquiez, he's a former French Minister for European Affairs under Nicolas Sarkozy, and he's a possible future candidate for the French presidency. And he gave an interview in the Libération, and it's a prominent French publication. And he said the European Union should expel between 15 and 20 member states to create a hard core of between 7 and 12 nations. So he's saying Europe really needs to integrate. That the 27 nations, that's way too big. We need between about 7 and 12 nations. And for years and years, we've been saying that a 10-nation superstate is coming. And now we see more and more leaders say exactly that. You know, between 7 and 12, that's about the right size for Europe. That's the right size to move forward for a superstate. So there's so much happening in Europe now to watch. We'll take a quick break and we'll talk about some more of that when we get back from the break.
The Trumpet Daily.
The human mind is a wonder. It can produce marvelous developments in science and technology. But the stark record of history shows the same mind cannot solve problems like war, illiteracy, poverty, starvation. The rapid advancements have not advanced world peace and have not prevented the evils that ravage our modern world. Mankind has proven tremendous at working with matter, yet history and events currently at play show man a devastating failure working with his neighbor. These truths raise many vital questions. What is human nature? Where did it come from? Did God create evil in man? And why has the mind of man produced such incredible advancement on the one hand, and on the other has not prevented calamitous evils? The answers are revealed clearly in the Holy Bible. Do you know what it says? There is no denying that our time has become fiercely evil. Is it even possible to escape the clutch of these seemingly unsolvable problems? For the remarkable answer, request our free booklet, Human Nature, What Is It? From thetrumpet.com.
The Trumpet Daily.
The bombs and the fires consumed so many lives. It's supposed to be a sacred and festive season, the last few days of the holy month of Ramadan. The attack happened at around 1 a.m. The streets were full and the shops were open. It's a time for giving presents. This was the so-called Islamic State's latest gift to the people of Baghdad.
Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Unfortunately, it's been quite a busy weekend in the news for, well, just in general, but for terrorist attacks like that. That was the attack yesterday, early yesterday morning in Baghdad, where a huge number were killed, many of them children, targeted from Islamic State, specifically targeting Shiites, Shia Muslims in Baghdad. Now, that wasn't the only terrorist attack over the whole weekend that came from, or that is claimed by Islamic State. There was also another one in Bangladesh.
A witness captures the moment Bangladeshi commandos stormed the restaurant where around 20 people, including foreigners, were being held hostage by gunmen. The upmarket restaurant in Dhaka's wealthy diplomatic area is popular with foreigners and middle-class Bangladeshi families. One hostage phoned his uncle and described what was happening during the attack.
My nephew said we've been kept hostage and the attackers said the police should not fire. They said, if they fire, we will kill you.
One restaurant worker who escaped by climbing on the roof saw two of the gunmen.
They were about 28 years old, definitely not older than that. They were tall and thin, and I got a good look at their faces. They were not bearded.
So after Friday night, we had that other organized attack in Dhaka, in Baghdad. And according to the reports now in the media, it seems like the terrorists, they came in there and they asked people to recite verses from the Quran. And in general, if people could recite verses from the Quran, they let them free. Then they tortured those that could not, and they said they were targeting foreigners. I think some of the other reports as well, people there expressed surprise at just how kind of Western-looking, sophisticated, educated these terrorists were. Even how polite they were. People were talking about how strange it was. They were with these hostages who were, or these terrorists who were shooting people, but who were just very polite in their communication before killing people. It was just a grotesque attack. The Daily Beast talking about both of these attacks, They write, as Iraqi forces have defeated ISIS in their founding city and former stronghold of Fallujah, ISIS must prove to its followers everywhere that even though it is down, it is not out. The rise in attacks everywhere during Ramadan is one way of doing that. But so too will be continued high-profile terrorist operations in the West. Expect more of those. How, we don't know. Well, there's still some disputing as to whether the Bangladeshi attack was ISIS. They've claimed that. The Bangladeshi government have said it wasn't ISIS, though, you know, they've got their agenda here. They don't want to... It may be that they just don't want to admit that the Islamic State is active in their country. But this attack, especially the Bangladesh attack, it was in a diplomatic area where, you know, at a high-end restaurant, the idea was that it would be a restaurant where there'd be lots of foreigners. It was something deliberately targeted at foreigners, as people from at people from outside the country. And as Brent talked about a bit on Friday on when he was hosting the program, this is something we're seeing more and more. And as Islamic State seem to be coming under pressure in their region, they really want to prove that they can still reach out and attack others. And so maybe there is a shift in focus here from holding on to territory in the Middle East to instead carrying out as many and as violent attacks as they can abroad. And these attacks show they still hate the West. They want to attack foreigners. Like this, the article in the Daily Beast said, you know, there'll be continued high-profile terrorist operations in the West. Expect more of those. And this is something that has Europe very worried, and they want to react. We've been talking about the EU's effort to form a European army spurred by these Islamic State terrorist attacks for quite some time now. And the EU's, they're basically their foreign minister, their head of foreign affairs and also security, Federica Mogherini. We've talked for a while about how she's been preparing a discussion on common security and defense. And the paper that she's written on that is finally published now in full. We have that paper. And she writes, "We need a stronger Europe. This is what our citizens deserve. And this is what the wider world expects." I'll just go through a few highlights from this. It was published before the most recent terrorist attacks, but obviously the whole general environment is taken into account in here. And she writes, "Internal and external security are even more intertwined. Our security at home depends upon peace beyond our borders. In a more complex world, we must stand united. Only the combined weight of a true union, she's calling for, a true superstate in essence, has the potential to deliver security, prosperity and democracy to its citizens and make a difference in the world." She talks about how the EU will engage in a practical and principled way in peacekeeping, in peace building. That's often a euphemism for sending in soldiers. She writes that investment in security and defence is a matter of urgency. Full-spectrum defence capabilities are necessary to respond to external crises. And so she writes, "Defence cooperation must become the norm." So that's just a sample of some of the rhetoric in there with what she's talking about. And it is a push for more European power, much greater, much more integrated European power, common defence. And one of the things that that really stood out to me from this report is its attitude towards America. There's a very clear, it comes across very clearly from this, they do not want to depend on America anymore. And this is a remarkable shift that's just taken place in just about 9 months or so, you know, less than a year within Europe. So, for example, this Brussels document says, "European security and defence should enable the EU to act autonomously, while also contributing to and undertaking action in cooperation with NATO." And then again, "Member states need the technological and industrial means to acquire and sustain those capabilities which underpin their ability to act autonomously." Talks about an appropriate level of ambition and strategic autonomy is important for Europe's ability to foster peace and safeguard security. "The EU should also be able to assist in protecting its members upon their request and its institutions." So we started to see this after the Paris attack. in November, the EU is very keen now to say, you know, look, let's not have our defense industries rely on America supplying our weapons. Let's not make sure that we can do everything that we want to do alone, that we don't need to rely on lifts from America to get our military abroad. Let's make sure we don't have any holes that we rely on America to achieve. Let's make sure we have our own satellites, for example, in space, so that we're not relying on American satellites. And it comes across throughout all of what Europe is trying to do. It's a concerted push to make sure their military is independent from America. This is something we focused on ever since the Paris attacks. And here's what Mr. Flurry, the Trumpet editor-in-chief, Gerald Flurry, said in a Key of David that he gave shortly after those Paris attacks.
Greetings, everyone. The terrorist attacks on Paris has caused a giant split between America and the European Union. Now, we've been prophesying this for over 60 years. What does it all mean? It is actually going to change the course of world history, just how they responded to those Paris terrorist attacks. That's how serious it is, and it is a rejection of America's leadership in the world. And I want to show you why it's so important. And the Bible prophecy tells us that it's going to have a massive negative impact on America and Britain and the Jewish nation in the Middle East. So where is it leading us?
A massive negative impact. This is a major, major trend to keep watching. And except we saw it after the Paris attacks, and it just keeps unfolding. For example, April 6th, the day before an important meeting between French and German officials, François Hollande, he had an interview and he said, he talked about how Germany and France need to work together on defense, and he said, and as well on the ability to act outside Europe. And he said, let's not rely on another power, even a friendly one, to do away with terrorism. So again, overtly saying, we can't rely on America. We mustn't rely on America. They're not taking care of the problems. They're not fixing these problems. We need to make sure we can do it ourselves. As I said, this is a big shift. And people in America, politicians in America, they should be asking, you know, why is Europe talking about acting without America all of a sudden? Being autonomous from America. Europe has been happy to rely on America for years and years. Why now are they saying, well, we need to be independent? But instead, European leaders have just kind of been saying, well, woo, we won't have to pay for as much defense because Europe can do it. And even pushing for Europe to do even more. That's something you see that both, as we've talked about, from Mr. Obama and from Donald Trump, saying, Europe, actually, you need to do more. Don't rely on us. They're encouraging Europe to become an independent power, a power that mistrusts America. There's a reason why America hasn't let Europe pay for its own defense for decades to have a large military. We've had relative peace for 60 years or so, at least in terms of major mass casualty wars. There have certainly been hundreds and hundreds of low-level wars going on. But none of these major wars because America just dominates the world. And if you have another world major power, as you would with a European military that is autonomous from America, the way these leaders are talking, then suddenly there's a potential for conflict that wasn't there before. So you have this paper calling on Europe to spend more on defense. They want Europe to work together more to do this. Now, if it was just Federica Mogherini saying this, then maybe it wouldn't be worth paying so much attention to. In going through this paper, it is full of kind of the usual platitudes of EU officials. The same type of talk but no action that has got so many in Europe fed up with Brussels. But this is far more than just Federica Mogherini. This isn't coming from just one person. Remember what we were saying before the break. These people opposed to Juncker and the Brussels bureaucracy, they want a European army too. And if anything, they want to go further than Federica Mogherini and the Brussels bureaucrats. And there's another important part of this defense paper. The Express, they wrote an article about it on Friday called EU Wants an Empire. Brussels hopes to expand its influence as far as Asia and Africa. I've been a little critical of the Express before because, you know, there have been quite a few times where they've had a dramatic headline and you go and you look up the source material for that article, you go and find the paper that that article is based on or the speech, and it turns out to not quite say what they said it says. But this time I think they're about right. That is the spirit behind this report, and it's couched in obscure kind of Euroese language and their terms and jargon. But the Express does cut through all that and say what the EU is talking about here. This paper talks about securing energy supplies. It talks about how dependent the EU is on having a Middle East that is at peace and a North Africa that's stable, and how that it's vital for the EU to, quote, stabilize the area. So just to quote a bit from this article, it writes, the EU wants to expand its influence as far and as wide as Asia and Africa. With critics fuming, it shows Brussels are planning to form its own empire. UKIP's defence spokesman Mike Hookham said, the EU wants its own empire, as former Commission President José Manuel Barroso made clear when he was in charge. This global strategy by the EU is yet another reason why last Friday's vote was a lucky escape for the UK. And this paper, it talks about it. It says, it is in the interest of our citizens to invest in the resilience of states and societies to the east, stretching into Central Asia and south, down to Central Africa. It talks about bringing in nations into Europe with the Eastern Partnership program. And it talks about forming deep and comprehensive free trade areas, trying to get Europe to have more links into this area. And it talks about paving the way for these countries' further involvement with common security and defence. So bringing them in, bringing these nations in on as far as defence goes. And it writes, the EU will engage in a practical and principled way in peace building, concentrating our efforts in the surrounding regions to the east and south. And again, peace building usually means peacekeepers, military peacekeepers. Right, we will invest in prevention, resolution, stabilization, and avoid premature disengagement when a new crisis erupts elsewhere. So not leaving these countries too soon. It also says it has long been known that preventing conflicts is more efficient and effective than engaging with crises after they break out. And it goes on to talk about preemptive peace building. Preemptive peace building, sending in the military before there's a disaster. Early warning is of little use unless it's followed by early action. It says we must develop a political culture of acting sooner in response to the risks of violent conflict. It writes, the EU will engage more systematically on the security dimension of these conflicts. So again, that's a lot of security dimension of these conflicts. It means the EU is going to be sending its military in more places more quickly. In compliance with international law, European security and defence must become better equipped to build peace, guarantee security, and protect human lives, notably civilians. And it goes on, I'll stop there in terms of reading quotes from this paper, but you're getting a picture now of a European Union much more willing to get involved militarily into North Africa, into the Middle East, stepping up where America has stepped back. That's what Brussels wants. That's what we see from this paper. But then we can also look at, and there's been some very interesting news over the last week or so. Well, what does Berlin want when it comes to getting involved in North Africa, getting involved in the Middle East? Well, German foreign policy, they recently had a couple of really interesting articles about what's going on within Germany. And they wrote a few days before the NATO summit in the Polish capital, Warsaw, German think tanks were demanding additions to the deployment of combat troops on the border with Russia and the expansion of the Western nuclear arsenal. And they read in an article which was published just prior to the talks taking place in the Polish capital in Warsaw on the 8th and 9th of July, the CDU-affiliated Konrad Adenauer Foundation committed to the development of Western nuclear arsenal. They called for a debate on the purpose and state of these nuclear weapons, and that Europe needed a credible deterrence to Russia, and they needed a nuclear component to this, or the need for a credible deterrence and a nuclear component to this deterrence. And so their demands for Europe and for Europe to step things up in terms of nuclear weapons, something I wrote on at the start of the year in an article called Europe Demands a Greater Role for Nuclear Weapons. And that was there were a lot of quotes from other German think tanks making the same point. For example, the SWP, the German Institute for International Security Affairs, saying Russia's aggression against Ukraine and Moscow's associated nuclear threats have triggered a new discussion in NATO about enhancing its nuclear deterrent. Some Central European states are demanding a greater role for nuclear weapons in order to do more to credibly deter further Russian aggression in Europe. And they talk about how Russia is playing military mind games with the West, and about how Europe needs to practice more with nuclear weapons to get response time down, to have greater control of the American nuclear weapons that are stationed in Europe so they can get them in the air more quickly. And this German foreign policy article, though, it didn't just talk about the nuclear weapons. It also talked about how NATO needs a spearhead force, a rapid reaction force for Eastern Europe. And they said that Germany should make significant contributions to this. It said that there should be a combat battalion in Lithuania under German leadership. And they also write a dramatic increase in defense budget is likely to be particularly necessary. So they're talking about a multinational reaction force led by Germany in Eastern Europe. And that's something that could take place as part of Europe and this push to a European army. It could take place outside of Europe multilaterally. I mean, the Germans don't really care too much which badge is stamped on that effort. So, again, it's one article from German foreign policy showing very similar thinking to Federica Mogherini and this push for Europe to do more, for Europe to be more capable, for Europe to spend more on their military. The same calls for Germany to spend more on its military. And the German foreign policy had another article that ties in especially with this European empire in North Africa and Middle East theme that comes across from the Federica Mogherini article. And this is a second German foreign policy article published within the last few days. And they write that Bundeswehr special forces are cooperating with the Turkish military. Paratroopers of the German Rapid Forces Division recently participated for the first time in a maneuver in Turkey. On the agenda includes several airborne operations and infiltrations of enemy territory. And then they talk about how this Special Forces Division have participated since 2005 officially in the training of military special forces in the countries of North and West Africa to increase the capability of these. And they talked about how Colonel Franz Rapp, head of strategy, I can't remember exactly where he was the head of strategy of, in the Defense Ministry, sorry, head of strategy in the Defense Ministry, talked about how it was important to improve the capabilities of the National Special Forces of North and West Africa in order to meet regional threats and thus make an important contribution to the security of the African space. And it talked about how the German Special Forces, they've been training a Tunisian special unit and that there's a troop training team and that they were flown in into Tunisia and that they've been participating in a train-the-trainer type program to help these African nations to help themselves. And then it talks about how the security studies at the University of Kiel have been talking about the importance of this, of building, training security forces of other nations to the core competencies of the Bundeswehr and investing in the ability for the German army to go on and then train other armies, especially, again, in North Africa and the Middle East. So right on in line with what Federica Mogherini was calling for, with Europe getting in more involved, sending in quote-unquote peace builders into these areas, and Germany also, they've been sending in their special forces, getting involved more militarily in North Africa, in the Middle East. And one of the prophecies that we've pointed to for a long time with the trumpet is the Psalm 83 Alliance, and this is a psalm that talks about an alliance between Germany and Europe and a bunch of nations that today are largely Sunni Islamic nations. Turkey is one of them. And so you're seeing German special forces participating in military exercises in Turkey for the first time, exactly in line with this prophecy, exactly in line with what we've been saying for years about the Psalm 83 Alliance And then, as I said, we see this across the Middle East and Africa. And with this attack in Baghdad, you can really see the tensions between Shiite and Sunni Islam just ramping up, and a greater appetite now for those Sunni nations to have Europe come and help them. In 2013, Mr. Gerald Flurry, he wrote, Northern Africa is turning into a battleground with enormously important prophetic implications. And he wrote, Iran has designs on being the strongest power throughout the region and is extending its reach throughout North Africa. But then he wrote, Iran isn't the only one interested in Africa. Germany is making strong inroads as well. Both of these powers are racing to get as much control of North Africa as they can. And we see this in Federica Mogherini's push now towards getting more involved in North Africa, as she was calling for there, with peace builders even getting in preemptively before there's a crisis, before Iranian-linked terrorist groups start taking a hold there, getting Europe in first. It's what we're seeing through Germany sending in its special forces to work with national militaries to train them to form just really crucial links with so many of these militaries across North Africa. And just one more news story from today that really strongly ties into this story. This is from the Deutsche Presse Agentur. The article's titled, Minister Defends Records After Doubling of Arms Exports. That's right, the economy minister, Sigmar Gabriel, on Monday defended his goal to reduce German arms exports despite the industry nearly doubling its business in 2015. So Sigmar Gabriel is from the left-wing SDP party, and when they joined Angela Merkel's coalition, they said they wanted Germany to export fewer weapons, and that in government they were going to work to stop Germany's weapons exports. And I think they probably have had a bit of effect. But even so, from 2014 to 2015, German arms exports, the approvals for German arms exports have doubled. This article writes, the Welt am Sonntag had previously reported that the 2015 arms exports, totaling 7.86 billion, nearly twice that of 2014, in which arms exports totaled 3.97 billion euros. Most of the overall sales were made to NATO members or other allied countries. But then it goes on to talk about a deal with Qatar, selling 1.6 billion euros worth of tanks to Qatar. And that's probably very roughly somewhere around $2 billion worth of tanks to Qatar. Qatar, another key member probably of this SAM 83 alliance, of this alliance of Sunni states. Germany is selling them tanks, building this alliance. So Federica Mogherini, she's calling for Germany to get more involved. German think tanks are calling for Germany to get more involved. German special forces, they're training, getting more involved in training troops in North Africa and the Middle East. They're doubling their weapon sales. You start to put all of this together, you get a really clear picture now of Europe emerging as a major military power. That's one of the key trends to be watching right now. I'll take a quick break and we'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. In 1945, the detonation of the atomic bomb in Japan brought an end to World War II with overwhelming force. This new technology ended the worst war this world had ever experienced. But with it came a new dangerous age. The age of atomic and nuclear energy had arrived, accompanied by weaponry capable of destroying all life on Earth. Man's number one problem now became that of human survival. After signing the Japanese surrender, General MacArthur spoke to America and the world about peace. And with it, he brought a grim warning. He said, "Men since the beginning of time have sought peace. Military alliances, balances of powers, leagues of nations, all in turn failed, leaving the only path to be by way of the crucible of war."
The utter destructiveness of war now blots out this alternative. We have had our last chance. If we do not devise some greater and equitable system, our Armageddon will be at our door. For today's program, we offer you two booklets at no cost or obligation to you. We Have Had Our Last Chance provides a hard-hitting, concise history lesson about the end of World War II and warning given by General Douglas MacArthur. In The Wonderful World Tomorrow, What It Will Be Like, Herbert W. Armstrong shows you where world evils are leading and how God will bring about peace and plenty. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. This is KPCG-FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily.
Welcome back to The Trumpet Daily Radio Show here on KPCG. It's 101.3 on the FM dial in Edmond, Oklahoma, or at kpcg.fm on the FM dial. If you would like to send us any feedback, you can email us at td@kpcg.fm. Large-scale war is too foolish, too fantastical to be thought of in the 21st century. Civilization has climbed above such perils. The interdependence of nations in trade and traffic, the sense of public law, the United Nations, liberal principles, modern democracy, high finance, Christian charity, common sense have rendered such nightmares impossible. Does that describe the world today? Many people think so. Instead, that's actually a slightly updated quote from Winston Churchill describing how many thought about the world before World War I. It's amazing, just throughout history, how many times mankind has thought that he has solved war, that there were never going to be any major large-scale wars, only to be proved wrong. I mean, incredibly, even before Napoleon, just before Napoleon, there was this growing belief that wars between major European powers were impossible now. They weren't going to happen. Your modern conscription and the modern science of war had made it impossible. Wars would be too destructive. People wouldn't fight. Generals would know who was going to win and who was going to lose before the battle, and rather than risking unnecessarily the lives of his men, the general that was going to lose would just step aside and give the one that would win everything that he wanted. That was a common theory that was very quickly completely proven wrong. And the Weekly Standard, they had an outstanding article published today called The Somme, 1916, Funeral of a Great Myth. It talks about the bloody battle fought 100 years ago on July 1st, where 20,000 British soldiers were killed in just one day, mostly within the first hour, 40,000 wounded. And this was a battle that continued all the way until mid-November. But this article writes, perhaps the most deeply held view in the years leading up to World War I was that Western civilization was marching inexorably forward, that human nature was evolving and improving, that new vistas of political, cultural, and spiritual achievement were within reach. Herbert Spencer, who converted Darwin's theory of evolution into a social doctrine, had much to do with this. And it talks about how there was all of this technological progress, and science was saying that mankind was continually evolving, and so therefore it said confidence in human progress led some to believe that with the help of modern technologies, wars could be fought with a minimal cost in life and treasure. Others argued that rational Europeans would soon dispense with war altogether. It talks about this book, The Great Illusion, published by a British author that became a runaway bestseller. And this talked about how that the economic growth and independence from the Industrial Revolution had changed the dynamic among nations, that there was globalization now, and so that all these major powers were losing the psychological impulse to war. And so just like wars of religion had died, other wars of the nation state were a thing of the past as well. And this article quotes H.G. Wells writing, "I think that in the decades before 1914, not only I, but most of my generation in the British Empire, America, France, and indeed throughout most of the civilized world, thought that war was dying out. So it seemed to us." And it just talks about how widespread it was. And in even the National Peace Council, they wrote a peace yearbook. They had a peace yearbook. And in 1914, their peace yearbook said, "Peace, the babe of the 19th century, is the strong youth of the 20th century. For war, the product of anarchy and fear, is passing away. Under the growing and persistent pressure of world organization, economic necessity, human intercourse, and the change of spirit, that social sense and newer aspect of worldwide life, which is the insistent note, the zeitgeist of the age." And this article talks about the change of spirit was heralded from virtually every sector of society. Scientists, educators, industrialists, salesmen, politicians, preachers, all agreed on the upward flight of humankind. Everything was getting better. Human improvement, even perfection, was a dogma it talked about. And it quotes a few more people just talking about how this myth was everywhere. And then a historian in The Passion of the Western Mind, Richard Tarnas, he wrote, "Man was responsible for his own earthly destiny. His own wits and will could change his world. Science gave man a new faith, not only in scientific knowledge, but in himself." That's what mankind believed in the run-up to 1914. And then this article goes on to talk about the Somme, with its 1.5 million dead in just this one battle in World War I, disproved that myth. But yet so many still believe it today. They believe, you know, major powers couldn't fight each other anymore. Modern trade has made it obsolete, just like people believed before World War I, even before World War II. I've been going through the textbook for international relations class at Herbert W. Armstrong College recently, Politics Among Nations, The Struggle for Power and Peace by Hans J. Morgenthau, who's really just a very good and very influential thinker in the world of international relations. And he does a great job in this book of just demolishing this continued myth that mankind can and has solved war. He talks about how there's this growing mood, at least when he was writing, of believing that science could solve war and lead to the pacification of human existence. He quotes people talking about how the science of politics will replace present-day statecraft. And he went on to quote all of these different influential figures who talked about how man could solve war and solve this problem through science. He talks about how men tried to reduce war to just a single cause. You know, some said the cause was feudalism. Get rid of feudalism, you'll get rid of war. And then others came along and said, well, actually, okay, war was caused by European nations' competition for colonies. Get rid of colonialism and you'll get rid of war. And then you had Marxists come along and say, well, no, capitalism is the cause of war. A communist nation would just lead to peace and would be free of war. And then all of these have failed. All of these different things that men have said will bring perpetual peace, you know, the Hague Convention, the UN, evolving mankind, they've all failed. Why? As Morgenthau writes, the causes for war have their roots in the innermost recesses of the human heart. And he's absolutely right. And he writes, the tendency to dominate in particular is an element of all human associations, from the family through fraternal and professional associations and local political organizations to the state. And he goes on to talk about how in family, in business, you know, everywhere, people clash with each other. Because people want to get something. And to get something, they need to dominate. They need to have power over another person or another group of people to get that. And so then because of this need of wanting to get, you have clashes everywhere, from within families to within companies and firms, within nations, between nations. Now, Morgenthau, of course, he never quotes the Bible in his book. But it is used as a textbook, and it is such a, at our college, and it is such a good book on international relations because he does have such a good understanding of human nature. Of course, his understanding is not perfect, but it, for a man out in the world, it's very good. And the Bible, you know, the Bible says the heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? The problem of war is the problem of the heart. And Morgenthau, to a certain extent, he sees that when he writes on, you know, the cause of war have its roots in the innermost recesses of human in the human heart. By contrast, here's what a modern book on international relations says, and it talks about Morgenthau's realist approach. Appeals to those of a very conservative and pessimistic disposition who take a pretty dim view of human nature. And instead, it talks about liberal institutionalism and talks about and shaping a society in which military powers become far less important or virtually irrelevant in shaping relations between countries. And people who believe this, he writes, have a much more optimistic of human nature and share the view that growing interdependence will strengthen the institution of regional cooperation and open up greater opportunities for strengthening the United Nations. So that's the thinking of the establishment. You know, well, viewing human nature as evil, that's just depressing and negative. We need a more positive view. We're getting better. Liberal institutions will stop war. Exactly as people thought before World War I. And this is why we need to pay attention to Europe rearming, to what's happening in the Middle East and Asia. You know, human nature has not changed. War stems from the innermost recesses of the human heart, as Morgenthau writes. Europe hasn't evolved between World War I, World War II. That's why we need to keep watching this remilitarization in Europe. What is happening there? The world hasn't advanced beyond war. But this also points to the solution to war. It lies in the human heart, in changing that heart. So it's not about about wanting power over others. It's not a change that man is capable of making, but it is a change spoken of throughout the Bible that God can bring about and will bring about in the future. And that's the hope that's there that's so important that you can go to the trumpet and find when we talk about things like Europe rearming. That's about it from me today. I'm not actually sure who's presenting the Trumpet Daily Radio tomorrow. You'll have to tune in next time to find out here on KPCG. It's at 101.3 on the FM dial and at kpcg.fm.